NPR's Don Gagne has been in public radio nearly 30 years. During much of that time, he's been a major voice bringing us information about presidents of the United States, members of Congress, and those aspiring to high office at the national level. When we recorded today's program over a year ago, he and his colleagues were gearing up for this year's presidential election.
You're doing your homework. You're learning about the candidates. You're talking to people in their hometowns. You're trying to build background and just deepen your knowledge about them.
On this week's Eastern Standard, NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne. He was with us last year to meet with WEKU listener supporters. We'll talk about Don's career, his employer NPR, politics, and other matters during this hour. It's a recorded show, but we encourage you to follow us on Twitter at WEKUEST or visit WEKU.FM for more information about this program and Don's visit. It's time for Eastern Standard right after the latest news from NPR. From the Griffin Gate Marriott Hotel and WEKU, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsberg, and thanks for joining us for this week's program, a special edition of the program. We are here with a very special guest, the annual WEKU Day Sponsor reception and taping of Eastern Standard features our guest Don Gagne, NPR. is NPR's national political correspondent. Don has been with NPR since 1986. He's covered the 2000 election and began reporting from Washington, D.C. in 2001. Outside of this, Don Gagne covers campaigns, elections, and political climate throughout the country. Don Gagne, thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be here, John. Good to be back on the radio with you.
Thank you. And we've had an opportunity to chat before, but let's begin at the beginning, as it were. I understand you have an anniversary coming up in just a few months.
I do, actually, February of next year. So when the next Iowa caucuses roll around, I will be marking that very week, 30 years in public radio.
So, let's talk about how you got involved in public radio. First of all, you did not originally envision yourself as a radio reporter.
Yeah, as a journalist at all. Yeah. But I have 2 degrees from Michigan State University, and one was in, they call it telecommunications, but basically radio, television, mass communications, and the other is in advertising. And so
you chose to work in non-commercial radio.
I parlayed that. I was such a promising student that they sent me to public broadcasting, I guess. You know, I knew I wanted to write. I knew I wanted to do something creative. I'd always been a news junkie from the time I was a little kid. It was one of the rituals with my mother, was watching Walter Cronkite or John Chancellor every single night. And I think that started when I was, you know, in second grade with the assassination of President Kennedy. And, you know, I think I understood the power of you know, a moment like that and how important it was to have good people to convey news like that. I heard about a job opening for a country western disc jockey at my local hometown radio station in Monroe, Michigan. And it was like, you know, it's not like they were going to pay a lot of money, so it's not like they they could be too picky. And I went in, and I think I just said yes to anything they asked me in the interview. And next thing you know, I'm introducing George Jones and Willie Nelson and Johnny Cash on the radio.
Well, tell us about a close encounter you had with Johnny Cash, because I found that fascinating. A couple of years ago, I think you may have referred to this online on Facebook or on the internet.
I did, and if people want to find audio of my encounter with Johnny Cash, I did a story about a year and a half ago on NPR about meeting him. So I'm working at this little country radio station, and I found out Johnny Cash was coming to the Monroe County Fair. And it was 1980 by then. It could have been 81. And this was not a great point in Johnny Cash's career or life. Especially, I read his biography and I kind of look back and I find out how rough it was to be a country legend and icon in 1980 as country music was changing and country radio was changing. Anyway, he came to the Monroe County Fair, and I tried to get an interview and tried to get an interview and tried to get an interview and couldn't get anybody to respond and couldn't work it out. So a guy at the fair kind of knew me, and I think took pity on me, and he said, his bus is there, The stage is there. The grandstand is there. If you stand here, he's going to walk past. So maybe at the very least you can get him to record something for your station. You know, hi, I'm Johnny Cash. When I'm in Monroe, Michigan, I listen to WV. You know, I'm not even going to try to imitate Johnny Cash. So that was all I was hoping for, but I was prepared. I had a bunch of questions in my head. And sure enough, he came by, and I introduced myself, and he stopped and talked to me for 10 minutes. And I ran out of questions. And I asked him what I thought were like kind of really stupid questions, like, what's your favorite song you ever recorded? You know, kind of stuff like that. And he was so nice. I asked him why he always dresses in black. And, you know, he's the man in black, right? So, 22-year-old kid, I said, why do you always dress in black? And Johnny Cash looked at me and he said, well, it's slimming. And then he actually gave a thoughtful, serious answer that's all in that song, which I recommend. Anyway, so I took that job as a country western disc jockey, and I got to know Johnny Cash. And because he was nice to me, and because he answered my questions, and because kind of my, you know, whatever ingenuity I had getting myself in that position paid off, that was a moment that I would look back on often as kind of, you know, it can work out. You can have really great things happen in this line of work.
So how did you end up on non-commercial public radio?
So I worked for this commercial station for 3 years. After a year, I just wasn't a very good country western disc jockey. But there was a guy in the newsroom, a little one-man news team, because back then, every commercial radio station even had a news department. So he looked like he was having more fun than me. So I took his job when he got a better job, and I spent a couple of years covering the county commissioners and the construction of a nuclear plant, and there'd be a debate about, you know, something about, you know, where they were going to put the parking lot for the employees at the nuclear plant at the Monroe County Commissioners meeting. And I'd go to that and I'd listen to the debate, and all the anti-nuke protesters would be there because any chance to protest, they were there to protest. And then I'd think to myself, how would Linda Wertheimer cover this story? Because I was an NPR fan. So I would kind of mimic my NPR heroes when I'm working for this little you know, commercial radio station. And the mimicking, I guess, paid off because a couple years later, the Detroit Public Radio Station hired me. And that's the 30-year anniversary that's coming up in February of next year. So my job at WDET was the station in Detroit. I was the morning news anchor. I did traffic and, you know, I would do live interviews and all that. And then they carried Morning Edition until 10 a.m. I'd work till noon. So until noon, I would, Coleman Young was the mayor of Detroit, I'd go, you know, see what he was up to, maybe go to a press conference, or there might be something percolating between the United Auto Workers Union and General Motors or whatever, so I'd go do that. I'd basically do spot news coverage and features until noon. And then, because I was making so little money, I didn't go home at noon. I freelanced stories to NPR. There was always a story that NPR wanted from Detroit. So I would kind of work 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., and about half of the day was trying to sell pieces as a freelancer to NPR. And eventually, that freelance work took over. And at some point, NPR just said, why don't you come work for us? Because I was turning down assignments from them.
Everybody at NPR got involved in the coverage of 9/11.
Yeah.
Talk about your role in that very significant and a monumental news day.
You know, it was like the nicest day ever. I mean, it was a September day, and it was just gorgeous. And I was at the White House already by then. I'd moved from Michigan to Washington in January of 2001 to cover the start of the Bush administration. So I was NPR's White House correspondent. On 9/11, Bush was in Florida. Everybody remembers those pictures of him reading to the kids at that elementary school in Florida. We'd already seen him give this education speech a couple of times, so we didn't go. Instead of waking up in Florida that day, I woke up at home, and I thought, this is great. I get to walk my daughters to school. You know, no hurry to get to work because Bush isn't at the White House. The president's not at the White House. So I walked my daughters to school, the public elementary school, just a couple of blocks from our house in D.C. Then I walked to the bus stop. So I was going to take Again, I was in no hurry. I was going to take the bus to the metro downtown to the White House. So I'm waiting for the bus, and my cell phone rings, and it's my editor, Ron Elving. And he says, listen, a plane apparently just hit the World Trade Center, and, you know, some kind of accident or whatever. He said, just when you get down, when you get to the White House, just keep an eye on, you know, whether or not the White House reacts to it or says anything. You might have to get some reaction. So while I'm on the phone with him, the second plane hits. And, of course, I mean, I kind of get a weird feeling in the pit of my stomach just saying that right now, even, you know, almost 14 years later. But so I didn't wait for the bus. I ran the few blocks to Connecticut Avenue, caught a cab on Connecticut Avenue, took the cab down to the White House. I remember at one point on that ride just kind of having this thought flash, I wonder if I'm going to a building that could be a target. But then you just don't think it anymore. Then you just kind of keep going. I mean, you got to get to the White House. It's not going to be a target. Of course it's not, right? Except we now know it indeed may have been. So I get to the White House, and I'm going through security, and I hear somebody who's already through security, kind of where the TV stations all do their live shots with the White House in the background. I hear somebody over there yell at that moment, the Pentagon has been hit. At that point, there was a lockdown, and then people started pouring out of the White House. And I have these very vivid memories. You get to know the Secret Service guys really well. They're like, you know, they're like local cops. All of a sudden, they've got, you know, automatic weapons, and they're pushing everybody out. And the young women who worked in the West Wing were running up the driveway barefoot, carrying their heels so they could run faster. You know, and the place was just emptying out, all of us out onto Pennsylvania Avenue. I'll wrap it up kind of with what was the single strangest moment. I'm hearing all these sounds swirling around, you know, people rushing and people screaming, and there are, you know, helicopters up above and the Secret Service guys yelling at you. And I'm thinking, I got to get some of this sound. I got to get some of this sound for my story tonight. So I kneel down in the middle of the street, and I get my gear out to start recording. And when I look up, I'm surrounded by men and women in kind of white tunics and tall paper hats, like dozens of them. And, you know, I had this, in that instant, I thought, this whole day is just a weird dream. And it was like I was in a Monty Python sketch or something. You know, they were like, everybody was in white tunics with tall white paper hats. Okay, so that evening, there was a congressional picnic on the south lawn of the White House planned. And these were all the food prep people there, dressed in their, you know, the white chef's smocks and their hat. They all got evacuated out the exact same door. And it's eventually I got through to my wife, who knew nothing about what was happening because she didn't have the TV on or the radio. And I had one of those very difficult conversations. We may not talk today. And if you feel like you need to get on the road and run, don't wait for me to weigh in on that if you can't reach me. You know, I mean, you can't believe you're having that conversation. But you're having that conversation. And then finally I got through to Morning Edition, and they put me on the air with Bob Edwards. And I spent, you know, the next 4 hours on that corner, off and on Morning Edition. So it was just, what a day. What an awful day.
Eastern Standard continues with NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne on the WEKU stations. Don Gagne is our guest on this week's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We are broadcasting from the Griffin Gate Marriott in Lexington. And Don Gagne is our guest for the annual WEKU day sponsor reception and meeting with our listeners. We have a room full of about 80 WEKU supporters, and we're going to invite them to be part of our conversation with their questions, their comments, maybe their personal stories of listening to NPR or to Don Gagne. And so we'll ask our guests to feel free to line up and be prepared to ask your question or offer your comment. But let me ask Don Gagne about, let's change to the beat that you have been on for the last number of years as national political correspondent. What are you doing right now related to the 2016 election? Anything in preparation right now?
We're gearing up. And this is a phase where, and it's been a phase that's been underway for months, where you're doing your homework, you're learning about the candidates, you're talking to people in their hometowns, you're trying to build background and just deepen your knowledge about them. We're also now trying to stay ahead of the curve on who's going to announce and when they're going to announce and how they're going to announce and whether we need to be there for that announcement. And it's a lot of it's a lot of juggling and prep work that's taking place at the same time. And the other thing you're doing is you're kind of taking a breath. You're kind of taking a breath because I think it's a little bit, is anybody a marathon runner here? I have a hunch it's a little bit like what a marathon runner is like the day or two before the race, where you know what's coming.
You're eating a lot of carbs.
You're eating a lot of carbs. You think you hope you're prepared. But you're also trying to get yourself in a mental place. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are, because it's a long haul. It's a long haul.
You are in Kentucky at the moment, mm-hmm. and Kentucky is perhaps more at the center of this national political scene than it has been in many years, a relatively influential situation. Talk about how you view Kentucky's role in national politics as of this year of 2015.
Kentucky's one of those fascinating places. It's, so I'm from Detroit, so I call this the South. And somebody in the audience here today referred to Kentucky as the Midwest to me. So I guess we, anyway, it's one of those states. Here you are. It's a Southern state with a Democratic governor and Democratic statewide office holders, but you don't send many Democrats to Washington. So it's a place that is it's fallen off our list of battleground states that we think even a Southern Democrat can carry in a national election. But I think most of the interest this time comes from your two United States senators. Obviously, Mitch McConnell in his new position as Senate Majority Leader, and then Rand Paul in the race. And as such, I would suspect I'll be here quite a bit. The only times I would come to Kentucky during a presidential year prior to this would be is if the campaign bus or plane happened to roll through here. I remember George W. Bush in 2000 did a big event in front of the Louisville Slugger factory. Anybody remember that? Factory and museum. I don't know if it was museum yet then. We didn't get here a lot, but I think there are a lot of reasons to come back here now, as long as Rand Paul is in the race and stirring things up. And we don't know how well he's going to do, but I think he's going to stir things up. I think I can safely predict that. So,
this is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We are going to ask members of our audience at the Griffin Gate Marriott to step forward with questions that you may have for Don Gagne, our guest. Don is national political correspondent for NPR and WEKU's guest of the listeners who have supported WEKU during the past year for the annual day sponsor reception and taping of the Eastern Standard program. Let me turn to the first of our guests. Please step right up to the microphone and your name, please.
Yeah, my name is Gerald Walker, and I had two questions.
Great, Gerald. Thank you for being here.
Will social media move us towards a purer democracy? And my second question, will we ever get to vote on Congress and legislators being in our Medicare and Social Security system?
Social media, I'll start with. I don't know that it's going to create a purer democracy. But I do know that it's going to play an increasingly meaningful role. I mean, it's already playing a meaningful role, but that's only going to increase. If I look back, even 4 years ago, I mean, Twitter was around, obviously, but now it feels like everybody's on it, right? It feels like Twitter is driving a lot of the conversation. And I feel like a lot of the stories I read are things that I've seen others post on Twitter. You know, maybe in years past I would have checked a handful of blogs every single day, and I would read them to see what they were up to. I might still read those blogs now, but I don't religiously check them every day. But I follow, I follow 1,000 people on Twitter, and a lot of them are journalists. A lot of them are political operatives. A lot of them are just regular civilians. I take a lot of cues from them, not in terms of what I think, but what I see in any given day. I feel like I'm seeing a wider variety of stories than the dozen or however many, I don't know how many blogs it was, I would go to every day. And then there's the dialogue that happens on Twitter, and there's campaigns trying to use it. And Facebook is a huge way, as we saw with the Obama campaigns, and others, in the midterms and the like, are catching on and catching up as well, for building communities of supporters and reaching out to them and going over the heads of the media and reporters to get your story out and to speak to people in kind of very, very direct and very personal ways. And I'm not even scratching the surface, about what it is and what it does. And then there's the ability, because it's all data, for numbers crunchers to analyze it and find trends and find what works. So to get it back to your original question, I don't know if that means a pure democracy or just, kind of the same thing we've got, only functioning almost at hyperspeed and hyperspace. And sometimes that feels good and sometimes that feels not so good. We don't have any control over it, obviously. The other thing is that whether or not we'll be able to vote to force members of the Congress and federal employees to basically be covered under, not have their own separate health insurance, is that what you're saying? That's the person I would bring here to answer that question or to discuss that question would be Julie Rovner, my colleague who covers healthcare. I couldn't predict. I don't know, but it's a question that's rooted in frustration, and that's a frustration that I do hear out there a lot. So,
thank you for that question, Gerald. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We're at the Griffin Gate Marriott and inviting our listeners who are present for the annual WEKU Day Sponsor reception and event to step forward and interact with NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne. Don, as a journalist with NPR for almost, in public broadcasting for almost 30 years, is there a challenge to your objectivity? To talk about the balance. Mm-hmm. I mean, you certainly have your own opinions, and hopefully we don't hear them mm-hmm. very often right. as a journalist. How do you balance that? How do you make sure that you are not coloring the reports that you deliver to millions of listeners every day with your own personal political views?
The short answer to that is, people, we have opinions. We're humans, and we're following things, and we're looking at things. But if I feel the need to impose my opinion on my listeners, then it's time for me to do something else, because that would break the trust that I have with them and the trust that they give me to kind of honestly report the facts, and the story without trying to slant it this way or that way. There's unconscious bias, right? And perhaps that comes through now and again. I hope it doesn't. I do get emails and comments at the bottom of my stories, as you can well imagine. I mean, we all do. Any given story tends to kind of elicit a charge of bias from multiple sides. A conservative sees it as an example that you're just another left-wing reporter, and a liberal or a progressive sees you as selling out to the right wing and not telling the true story. And the same story will elicit those kinds of reactions.
Do you hear it from both sides?
Yeah.
Because I know we frequently, and many in local stations, and I'm sure at NPR, hear that NPR could be accused of being left-leaning. Mm-hmm.
And I cover Republicans, right? And I'm at Republican rallies, or I'm at Tea Party rallies. And if somebody if somebody levels that kind of an accusation at me, I always do something. I say, listen to my stories. They're all online, and pick any 5 or 10 you want to. And sometimes I'll even give them my business card, and I'll say, if you find something in there that is biased, I'd love to talk to you about it. I obviously people bring their own biases when they hear stories as well, and they have a sense of what they want a story to tell. I feel like my job is to be an honest broker, and say what I learned, offer what analysis is there that can be offered, but never from an ideological perspective, because that's not my job. There are others we have on who will opine based on their political beliefs, and we have them on the shows all the time, and if you listen, we have them from across the political spectrum. But it's not my job to do that. And then the other thing is, I've been doing it for a long time, and ultimately you just want to be judged by your work. You want to be judged by your work. And I would hope that if people listen to my work, they hear somebody who's doing their best to be a fair-minded person in telling a story. And that's the goal. But ultimately, you're judged by your work.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations, a special edition of our program with NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne at the Griffin Gate Marriott Hotel. And we are going to invite another member of our audience to step forward and ask your question or offer your comment. Please identify yourself.
I'm Karen Summer Southall, and I had a question about how I was going to figure out how I was going to work this question into it, but since you're Johnny Cash story, I am from Hendersonville, Tennessee, which is a suburb of Nashville, and I don't know if you know this, but that's where Johnny Cash lived when you met him. Mm-hmm. And I was in band that wore uniforms that he raised money for and played at his dedication of the Johnny Cash Memorial Parkway in Hendersonville, Tennessee.
Is that where the House of Cash
exactly
is?
Okay, that's where I'm from.
Okay.
So I am from Kentucky. I don't necessarily agree with my federal representation. That's a good way of saying it. Mm-hmm. But I'm always amazed that the senators from Tennessee, talking about your non-biased reporting, how the Republican senators from Tennessee, Lamar Alexander and Corker, are able to not always go with the Republicans. And I wonder how they get away with that. I don't know if you have any opinion. Plus, I also want to hear about your trip through Iowa on your bike ride.
Oh, okay, okay. Corker and Alexander are kind of a different breed. Of Republican. They would certainly call themselves conservatives, and a lot of people, certainly agree with that. And they keep getting elected. I think what you're describing is just a product of their particular personalities and their choice, that this is just the way they're going to do it. And it works for them with their personalities in their state. You could take them and transplant them to Chase, which might not work. But it is interesting that you kind of lump them together, because certainly they do kind of function in similar ways, which is not to say that they don't take a lot of heat for it. they do sometimes from within their own party. And certainly from the opposition party as well, but I think it's a product of not just where they're from, but the kinds of politicians they are and the personalities they have.
We're talking with Don Gagne. This is Eastern Standard on WEKU.
She had other questions. The bicycle ride.
Oh, she did want to hear about the bicycle ride. Yes, and we actually all do want to hear about that.
I'll do this kind of quickly, but. So when you go to Iowa a lot, you start hearing about this thing that Iowa does every year. And the Des Moines Register sponsors an annual bike ride across the state. And it started 42, 43, maybe 44 years ago. Way back then, a newspaper columnist from the Des Moines Register decided he was going to, on his vacation, ride from the Missouri River on the western border of the state to the Mississippi River on the eastern border of the state, and every day he would file columns along the way. So he started riding with a couple of buddies, and you know, they rode as far as they could every day. They made it in a week. By the time they got to the end, I think they had a caravan of hundreds of riders with them. It became a thing. So they did it again the next year. So you start hearing about this annual ride when you go to Iowa. So Scott Horsley, who's my colleague who covers the White House and who covers politics and campaigns for NPR, he and I were always talking about it. And I think he saw an article about it in the Wall Street Journal one year. And the thing that sold him on it, and me, if I'm honest with myself, was the article focused on the amount of pie you eat as you ride your bike across Iowa. And that it's, you know, it's about a 400 or 500 mile ride. It's apparently like the one big athletic thing that you can do where you can eat all the pie you want and not gain weight. Not gain any weight. So the pie was the lure. We did it 2 years ago and started in Council Bluffs and ended, I think, in Fort Madison. And we had a blast. We just had such a blast. And now there are like 20,000 riders who do it, and they block off the roads. And you ride 70 or 80 miles every day, and you eat a lot of pie along the way. And in every town you stop through, it's like the biggest thing that's ever happened in that town. It's a different route every year. No two rides have been alike. And if anybody's a rider, I highly recommend it. And it's not like it's a huge athletic feat. I mean, you have to get in shape, and you have to get your hindquarters used to being on a bike for 7 days straight. But it's just a blast. And we've done it twice now, and I can't do it this year because of family stuff this summer, but Scott's doing it again, and Tamara Keith's going to join him from NPR, and Joel Palka is going to join him. So it's our gang is growing. But I go back to Iowa now on reporting trips, and I'll go to the VFW hall in Mount Pleasant or wherever, and people will say to me, oh, you're that guy who rode your bike across Iowa. And now I'm not just some reporter from Washington, D.C. who wants to stick my mic in front of your face and ask you what you think about, you know, Hillary Clinton. Now it's kind of like, oh, yeah, hey, you're one of us. Well, you know, you're an honorary Iowan. And it is. We didn't do it for that reason. But it's amazing how much it's helped our reportings. Plus, and this is kind of obvious, I guess. But man, you get to know a state when you're riding across it on your bicycle in ways that you don't when you're in your rental car or in a campaign plane. So it has enriched our reporting and it's enriched our lives. So think about it if you're thinking of a fun July bike ride.
Eastern Standard continues with NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne. It's a program we recorded May 1st, 2015 at the annual WEKU Day Sponsor event. NPR's national political correspondent Don Gagne is our guest on this week's special edition of Eastern Standard, taped at the Griffin Gate Marriott Hotel and Spa as part of WEKU's annual day sponsor recognition and reception. And Don, talking about, we certainly want to talk with our audience. So if our audience members here at the Griffin Gate Marriott would like to ask a question or offer a comment or tell a story, please step forward. But let me ask one more question here before we go to our next audience member. Don, you talk about meeting people in Iowa and becoming an honorary Iowan. Talk about the somewhat different approach you take to covering the political campaigns. You don't necessarily ride on the plane, mm-hmm. the press plane, the bus. You're not part of the gang that, and I've been to political yeah. events where all of a sudden the doors open and whoosh, this rush of reporters shows up and they're back in a corral, essentially. You're not part of that batch that's traveling around?
I've been in that. It's the bubble. It's the famous bubble, you know? There are advantages to being in the bubble. Where the candidate goes, you're going. And where the candidate goes, the candidate's, you know, advisors and staff and a lot of key people in the campaign are there. So you have proximity. But it's getting harder and harder, even if you're in the bubble and on the plane, to get, quality time with those folks. And in the age of Twitter and smartphones streaming live video, of any instant at any time, candidates are far less likely to come back to the back of the plane and have, 15, 20 minutes off the record or something a little more casual. And those moments are, sometimes revealing, but they're happening less and less.
Well, that is because they don't, because it's never really off the record?
It's either never really off the record, it can still be off the record, but there's just more wariness.
They can go more directly to the American people?
Yeah, and they can go more directly, but there's more wariness and there's more, don't go back there. Just don't go back there. Nothing good's going to happen if you go back there and stand in the middle of that, pack of reporters.
And so you do take a different approach, and NPR supports you in taking this different approach?
Yeah, we still have had people on the planes because you have to have somebody there in case something happens. But I did it for a chunk of 2000. I did it in 2004. In 2008, I essentially got on Obama's plane the night of the Iowa caucuses and got off his plane election night in Chicago. So that was quite a thing to witness and quite a story to tell. I had days off in there, so but it was a long haul. So in 2012, I was not on one of the buses, and it comes with senior status, I guess. They let me take a broader view. They let me go the place where the buses or where the circus isn't going on that day and see if there's a story about the campaign. If everybody's over here, maybe there's an interesting story over there. So I get to be the guy who goes over there. And what you hope is at the end of a long campaign, it's still a long campaign, no matter where you are, inside the bubble or out, you hope that at the end of the campaign, you can look at the stories you did and kind of the arc of the narrative over the many months that you were chasing this one big meta story and that you've captured a really interesting piece of it. That's the hope.
We have listeners standing by with questions and their interest in interacting with Don Gagne on this week's Eastern Standard. Please step forward with your question, your comment, your personal story, and of course, please identify yourself.
I'm Diane Bazell, and I'm an avid listener of WEKU and NPR. And I wanted to go back to your comments before on objectivity.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you what you think the effect of different types of patronage are on the ability of public broadcasting to be objective and to be free. For example,
mm-hmm.
you have a very well-known large bequest that's given you an endowment. Does that make you freer than some other varieties of public broadcasting that are more dependent on immediate large donors?
I don't want this to sound like a cop-out or a dodge,
because
it's going to sound like both of those things. I don't even think about where the money comes from. Broadly speaking, I know a chunk of it comes from listeners and what an important component that is. And it's why I'm fundraising on local stations.
I'm thinking of larger.
But you're thinking of like either corporate or foundations or.
Or the Kroc that gives you a blanket.
Right.
What was that, $200 million?
It was $200 million from Joan Kroc.
Yep.
I think it was the largest single gift of its kind. And
that
the Salvation Army got
place.
A big chunk too. I'm just not comfortable kind of talking about the impact or where it comes from or whatever, just because I mean, there really is a firewall between that and the editorial side that I'm on. Now, I can tell you, nobody tampers with our editorial decisions. We go into our Washington desk weekly meeting, and I have daily discussions with editors. And where the money is coming from just doesn't come up.
And you have the freedom to do that because you have a large endowment.
We don't live off of that money. It's an endowment, and what it spins off is
our role either.
Yeah, it's It's good to have it. Yep. It's good to have it, but it's just a small part, I think, of our operating budget. It's very meaningful. Mm-hmm. But I think there are people at the organization who are raising money all the time and always looking. And whatever they're talking about and whoever they're talking to, I just don't want to know it. And I have to tell you, I don't even listen to the fundraising underwriting credits on NPR when I listen. Like, I couldn't tell you who underwrites All Things Considered in Morning Edition. And it's
Your science reporting and the climate debate has not been affected by particular large donors, in other words.
I can't really answer. I don't think it has. I don't think it has. But you know what I mean? It's I know there is a firewall between the money side and the reporting side, and that's as it should be. And that's it. But beyond that, I can't really, can't speak beyond my desk and my personal experience.
Thank you for that very important question.
But it's a good tough question that I just can't answer.
We want to get other listeners involved, but very briefly, Don, how have you seen changes? What do you perceive in terms of these almost 30 years since you've been in public broadcasting? NPR was really a fledgling organization in 1986, not at all the organization it is today, an influential journalism, a journalistic enterprise. I mean, did NPR have a seat, for instance, in the White House press room in those early days? And how has that evolved in terms of the bureaus that now exist across the nation and around the world?
The growth has been just, remarkable. I mean, we had a very intensely loyal audience then, but relatively speaking, a small audience. And the way I hear it described is a lot of people saw NPR as a place that was like a supplementary news source for them. They listened every day. They loved it. But they got most of their news from the New York Times or from their local paper or wherever. And NPR, over the decades I've been there, has become a primary news source for millions and millions and millions of listeners. And our audience has grown accordingly.
How do you feel about that? You're now you were part of an alternative, and now you're part of the established mainstream media in so many ways.
I don't know that we were content being part of an alternative. And when I was those would have been my early days in Detroit. I never thought when I went to a news event, and there were all the other media there covering it as well. I never thought, well, they're going to cover that, but I'm the alternative, so I get to do this. I just wanted to tell the story well. And often I had more time to tell the story. I always had more time to tell the story if they were broadcasters. I might not have had as much time as the New York Times reporter or the Washington Post reporter or the Detroit Free Press reporter had space in the paper. But if I was different, I just felt like I had more time to tell a story, which maybe allowed me to either get more in or tell a more nuanced story. But now we really are an institution, and we're a mainline institution. And there was a day early on when, I would call people up and I'd have to tell them what National Public Radio was, what NPR News was. And I never have to do that.
How is that better anymore for the listeners and the supporters of our public radio stations today?
We have more clout as a news organization. People are more likely to return our calls. We have, more listeners means more resources. And it's why we have these bureaus around the world in places that that no other broadcast news organization in the U.S. Has. It allows us to do more, but it's also, for listeners, it means we're probably a more complete news organization than we were back then. I love those golden days of National Public Radio, but there was a lot of stuff we didn't cover or couldn't cover, and now we tend to be able to cover everything we need to cover.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations, and we are at the Griffin Gate Marriott with WEKU listeners, supporters who are present with NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne. Go right ahead.
Thank you. My name is Gail Bourne. I'm a nonprofit administrator here in Fayette County, and I wanted to pick up your earlier comment that Kentucky had sort of dropped off your swing state list of states that have any real swing in the way the elections go. It is true that Kentuckians, as a general rule, are loyal, loyal to a fault. I would not argue with that. But a person who is loyal and has been burned is far more likely to react than someone who is ambivalent in the first place. A lot of Kentuckians are starting to realize that they're being exploited by large corporations that could be paying them living wages and aren't. They have no savings, they have no retirement, so they rely entirely on Medicare and Social Security for their old age. And as these things start to be debated more, and it's very clear that the Republican Party is in favor of policies that would hurt the average red state person, a family, do you think there will be a backlash against the GOP at some point? Kentucky can't be the only red state whose citizens are largely dependent upon liberal policies to sustain them. Surely that's going to show up in the political spectrum at some point in the future. How do you think that will play out?
Yeah, I don't predict elections, and I don't predict how things might play out down the road. But I think these are all the things. I mean, I cover campaigns, I cover politics. These are all things that, if they are as you say, it's the kind of things that we will hear from Democrats in statewide races, for federal office, for state office, but also in the legislature.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne, our guest. And WEKU listener supporters are present at the Griffin Gate Marriott for the annual WEKU Day Sponsor reception and event. Go right ahead with your question or comment, sir.
My name is Nathan Rice, and I had a question regarding the primaries. So when we lead up to these presidential elections, we get this huge field of candidates, but it seems like before we get a chance to vote on them, states like Iowa and New Hampshire have the biggest say in what's going on. So my question is, can a person from Kentucky or a non-Iowa state realistically have as big of an influence as an Iowa citizen?
Iowa and New Hampshire have a huge amount of influence. And they get a lot of the attention. But again, they don't necessarily pick the winner. They're just, because they're first out of the block, candidates all know they can get momentum, they can make a name for themselves in those places. But Rick Santorum won the Republican caucuses in Iowa last time. Now, it was really close, and on caucus night, we thought Romney had won by 5 votes. And Santorum didn't go on to win the nomination. Mike Huckabee won before that, the Iowa caucuses on the Republican side. Of course, Barack Obama won the Iowa caucuses, and it was a huge thing that kind of gave his campaign momentum. But then he turned around and lost the New Hampshire primary to Hillary Clinton. So they get a lot of attention, and they have an opportunity to make a big statement and a big potentially big statement right up front. But it doesn't mean they're, decisive.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We are with NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne, and members of our audience are folks in attendance for the WEKU Day Sponsor reception and event at the Griffin Gate Marriott in Lexington. Go right ahead, sir, and identify yourself.
Hello, my name's Noah Day. I was just wondering, with all the buzz around the elections and all the coverage, what do you look for in a story to make it unique and make it stand out amongst all the other coverage of the elections?
We've at NPR, we've got a little time to let our stories breathe, for starters. So, if I've got 4 minutes or 5 minutes or 6 minutes to tell a story, it doesn't have to just be here are the facts, bang, 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 and kind of, get through the end. And that is kind of what you see in other broadcast outlets. You compare us to, digital or print, the radio stories just come to life with sound in ways that the words on the page, they just don't. It's a different medium, it's a different way to speak to people, and it's a different way to tell the story. But if you compare us to other broadcast outlets, I can set a scene a little better, and sometimes a scene helps create a mood, and a mood helps to kind of let you understand a little more what it was like to be in that room, or you can get into a little more nuance on policy or an argument. Every story is different. Every story is different, and you have to look at the elements that you have and what the goal of that story is too. I mean, if it's a policy speech about, you know, the candidate's approach to law enforcement and policing in the wake of Baltimore and other unrest we've seen around the country, you're covering that speech. And you're talking about what's in it and why it's in it and why that candidate might be saying those things. But if it's Rand Paul, 2 days after he announced and he's got this, libertarian background and his father who's very, opposed to U.S. intervention around the world, and he's doing the event in front of an aircraft carrier in Charleston, South Carolina, that's a different kind of storytelling. That is kind of about the place and the moment and how the setting either, is supported by his words but fits in with his larger history. So but every story is different, and you're always looking for that pathway through the information that keeps the listener there and that brings the listener along and tells them, things they need to know and can use.
Noah, thank you so much for your question. NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne, we're glad you're here with us in Lexington, Kentucky for the annual WEKU Day Sponsor reception and for the taping of Eastern Standard. Thank you for being with us, Don, and we look forward to hearing more of your reporting as you lead us through the campaigns and the 2016 election. And congratulations on your 30th anniversary in public broadcasting.
Yes, thank you. It's an honor to be here, and keep up the great work you guys are doing here. It's important to us, too.
Eastern Standard is a production of WEKU at Eastern Kentucky University. Our producers for Eastern Standard are Richard Turner and Logan Riley. And we are welcoming on board Noah Day, who's now a member of our team for Eastern Standard. And we thank our audience in attendance here for this week's broadcast at the Griffin Gate Marriott Hotel. Thank you all for being here, and thank you for your support of WEKU.